like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Terry.
Hi, guys. How are you? My name's Terry, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 23rd, 1997. My sponsor is Defio, and my home group is Drunks Only. And I say that because I think it's important for the newcomer to understand that the most important date that you'll have in recovery is your sobriety date, and that it's important to have a sponsor. Without a sponsor, you won't be able to work the program thoroughly and have a clear understanding of what your path is without a sponsor. And, of course, I firmly believe in a home group where you can establish relationships and friendships and fellowship and allow people to get to know you as well as you get to know them. So it's important. I'm super glad to be here tonight. It's always an honor to speak in front of a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're my people. There's a lot of people here that I know and I love very, very much that are here to support me. And there's people that I don't know, and you're just as much family to me as anyone else, because we're all alcoholics, we're all in this together, and we're all fighting this deadly disease together. And I want to thank Lori for asking me to speak. It's an honor and a privilege. Thank you. And thanks, Michelle, for that warm-up. What a great message. It's funny, right before I got called up, come here, Michelle goes, "You may want to check your fly. I think it's down." And, of course, I looked, and... not knowing that I have this podium here. You know, what I'll share tonight is, nothing what I share tonight and nothing that I say that comes out of my mouth is original. It's either something I've heard from someone else in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous or something I've read out of the big book of the 12 by 12. For me, when I get a chance to speak, I tend to focus more on the message than the mess. I can tell you what it was like and what happened. I grew up in a household. My father was an alcoholic. He was born in Ireland. He came here from Ireland, the old country, and he loved to drink his Jamesons. And my mom was born in Mexico, and she came to this country, and she loved her tequila. And on special nights, it was a special night, it was the mezcal, you know. So growing up in a household with a drunk father, and what I come to find out, at the time I thought was mentally ill mother, who was very violent. I learned to become an alcoholic way before I took my first drink, because I was raised in this environment that was very dysfunctional. It was very unhealthy. It was very uncertain, you know. And my mother left when I was 2 years old, and I don't know if that was a blessing or a curse, but I know that she left me with a father with six kids. I was the youngest, and he had a drinking problem, and he didn't know how to get sober. So when I grew up in an environment of the disease of alcoholism, I grew up in a place where there was very little attention paid to me because I was the youngest, number one. And number two, my dad was fighting for his life. He didn't know how to get sober or stay sober. My mom had left, and the only time you heard from my mom was when my dad was one of those drunks. He would get up in the morning, he would go to work, he'd come home, he'd make whatever dinner that he could make, and then he'd go straight to the whole local neighborhood bar. And so the only time my mom came around was when she'd call us and she'd say, "Is your dad home?" And of course she knew he wasn't going to be home because he's going to be at the local bar. So she would come over and wait for him. And she'd wait behind the door for him to walk in the door. And my dad was met with baseball bats and frying pans and ironing pins and irons, whatever tools she thought that was the best that night to use on my father. And the worst part about that was that she made us all sit on the couch and watch. So I grew up in a house like that. But what happened was I grew up to be a little boy that was terrified. Terrified, who couldn't understand the environment that I was living in, didn't understand what was going on, didn't understand what a parent, a real healthy, nurturing, loving parent was and what it was supposed to be like. All I knew was fear. And I was riddled from fear from a very early age. So I also learned at a very early age that there were secrets. There's big secrets in my house because, you know, we were Catholic and no one was supposed to know that my parents were divorced and no one was supposed to know my dad was a drunk. So we could never tell that information to anyone. We could never share that with anyone. And so I learned at a very early age what it was like to keep a secret. And then I learned how to live a double life at a very early age. You know, because kids would ask me, "Well, let's go over to your house and play." I'm like, "No, we can't go over to my house and play." You know, and they're like, "Why not?" I'm like, "Well, we just can't." You know, and the reason was because, you know, my dad would come home from drinking, and he'd pass out on the couch or on the chair with his lit cigarette on his hands, and every single piece of furniture in my house had big, giant burn holes in them, right? So the last thing I want to do is bring my friends over to see that. and of course run into my drunk dad. So, you know, growing up in that environment, long before I took my first drink, I learned to be an alcoholic. I learned how to think alcoholically. I learned how the, what the character defects that later on in my life became so deadly to me. I learned how to lie really well, became a really good liar. And I became someone who knew how to manipulate well because I watched all of this happen to me. You know, and like I said, some of the earliest memories that I have of my childhood is some of the most, you know, painful ones was the, you know, watching my mom attack my dad and make us watch during that, and I never understood that, you know, and I grew up just so resentful over that, so angry, didn't quite understand that. And then the other real big memory that I have of my father is that by the time I was about 8 or 10 years old, all my older siblings had got the hell out of the house. They moved and they got out as quick as they did. Some left at 15, some left at 16. Others left the minute that I graduated from high school and never looked back. And so I was left at home with my father, and he would go out to drink, and then I'd lay in bed just worried and terrified, you know, if he was going to come home. And then I would wait for the door to open, and I would always help him. And more than likely, he'd always get in a fight, you know, and he'd always come back and bloody. And then I'd have to help him in the bed, make sure that he was okay and that he didn't light a cigarette. And this is at 10 years old. So I didn't grow up in a normal home. So the point of all this and sharing all this information is that you don't have to take a drink to learn how to be alcoholic. You don't have to take a drink to learn to think like an alcoholic or be affected by the disease of alcoholics or alcoholism, because it is a family disease. It affects everyone within our family. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But, you know, the point being is that I don't want to share so much about the mess. I want to share more about the message. And what happened to me was I grew up scared, terrified of myself and everyone. And then until I was 14 years old and I took my first drink, and everything changed for me, just like everyone else talks about in AA. You know, the fear was left. You know, I felt comfortable. I felt like I fit in. The memories that I had experienced and the life that I was living at home all disappeared in a heartbeat. And I was instantly hooked. And an interesting part about it is the first time I got drunk with a bunch of buddies. I was always the run in the group, and they were always bigger than me. And they could not drink anymore. They were throwing up and passing out in bushes, and I was like, let's go get some more, you know? And I thought that was really strange at the time, but it turns out that I was an alcoholic, you know, I just didn't know it. So fast forward, you know, I went through high school and I partied, and it was pretty good. It was, you know, the 70s, you know, with cocaine, pot, drinking. It was all on like Donkey Kong, and we loved every minute of it, you know. And I managed to do okay. I had a terrific girlfriend. I had a job. It seemed like I was doing really well. But I was a people pleaser, and I would do well in school for your approval, but outside of school, turn your back, I'd steal your wallet, you know. And I was a manipulator and a liar and a cheat and a thief back then, and then my disease hadn't even kicked in yet. So, you know, I graduated from high school, I hang around, and during this time, my father decides to get sober, right? I think I was a junior in high school. My dad finally made it to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. All I knew is that my dad brought home the coffee pots, and he always had all this literature sitting in our den. And all I knew is that every week on Tuesday, he'd go to a meeting, and I'd break out my bong, and it was great. You know, I had a whole hour to get stoned before Dad came back from his meeting. But an occasional beer, too. So, but, you know, I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was, you know. But, you know, by the grace of God, eventually my dad did get sober. And God rest his soul, he died in 1994 with 22 years of sobriety. And I still got his big book. I still got his 12x12. I still got his 24-hour-a-day book. And somebody in this room bet me I was going to cry tonight. I told him, I go, I'll bet 20. And Mel's back there waving a 5 at me right now. And I'm like, I go, I'll bet you 20, I don't do it. She goes, how about 5? I'm like, you're on. That's an easy 5. Still haven't done it yet. And I also might lose a bet. I already lost one bet because I bet Lori that Troy wouldn't show up, and he showed up. So I lost one bet, two bets tonight. We'll see. But what happened was You know, I got busy being an alcoholic. I got the ultimate job as an alcoholic. I became a bartender in nightclubs here in San Diego. What a free pass. It's like the wolf being led into the chicken coop. You know what I mean? Free booze and drugs from customers, and I loved every minute of it. But I was going nowhere, and I was going nowhere fast. And I remember the day that I finally came to a real quick conclusion when I was working at a nightclub and someone gave me some cocaine. I went into the bathroom and I spilled the cocaine on the floor, and I was so desperate for that cocaine, I scraped it off the urine floor and I snorted it. The next day I quit bartending. That's how low it got, you know. Fast forward, I reach a point where I quit bartending. I'm lost. I move in with my dad. I'm so desperate. I just want to be sober. I just don't want to live that life anymore. So I'd stayed sober for a year through exercise, and my dad took me to a few meetings, but it didn't click for me. And then I met the woman of my dreams. And so I thought. And, you know, I got married, and I got married for all the wrong reasons, because I got married because I thought, you know, I'm sober now. And I spent my whole life trying to please my dad. And one thing about my dad was that he was incredibly hard on me as a kid growing up, and more so than my siblings. And I never understood that, you know. So I grew up wanting to please my dad really bad, and I thought, you know, getting married and staying sober, and then I got this, you know, a decent job, and I thought, you know, this is going to make dad proud of me, you know. So I did it for all the wrong reasons, and, you know, that marriage didn't last. It lasted 6 years, and I got a really good job after that, and I started having kids. And, you know, I had the marriage, had the great career. I had a beautiful young daughter, and in 1994, it all came to a crashing head because my drinking was enhanced by crystal methamphetamine, and I thought, you know, or as my friend Dave Cook calls it, methanol. And so I hit rock bottom, and in 1 year, my father passed away, which was really difficult for me because I had this cantankerous relationship that never got healed with him. And but I do have a story about that I'll talk about later. And he died, and I was angry, and I was pissed. And all in the same month, my dad passes away, my wife kicks me out, gets a restraining order, and changes locks on the door, and I get fired from my career. And then I said, fuck it. This is the absolute perfect time for me to burn through all my cash and have a party, which is what I did. And I spent the next 3 years drinking myself to death and partying myself to death. And where it comes now, full circle, is that, you know, I found myself, you know, I tell my stories a lot. I'm not going to tell you my whole story because, you know, there's a lot of, you know, consequences in my story. You know, 5 felonies, facing 5 years in a state penitentiary. And I would tell my story to a group of small friends, and they would say, I'm one of those guys that's then you got sober kind of guy. So I would tell my story to my friends, and they would go, then you got sober? I'm like, no, I didn't get sober then. I tell a bit more, and they're like, fucking for sure you got sober then. I'm like, nah, I didn't get sober then either. So where that led me was it led me to places that I never thought I'd go. You know, 3 years earlier, I'm flying all over the country. I'm working for a high tech company. I'm married. I have a house. I have a kid. 3 years later, I'm completely broken, and I'm homeless. I'm living in the park, occasionally in a 1972 El Camino pickup truck that I had to my name, and a bag of clothes. And I was sick. I was dying from this disease. I was 130 pounds. I had sores all over my face, and I couldn't do it anymore. And this is where the first step comes in for me. I remember growing up, there was a couple next door to me that were old hippies, and I got to know them, and they liked to smoke weed. So I used to go over to their house and smoke weed, and they used to call me son. I used to call them mom and dad. I hadn't seen them in years. It burned a lot of bridges. There's no one left for me to talk to, no one to call. No one to beg anything from. So I just had I don't know what it was, but I decided, you know, I'm just going to go up and I'm going to knock on that door. I'm going to just ask him. I was so tired. I wanted to sleep in a bed for one night. I wanted to take a shower and I wanted to eat something. And I knocked on the door and the woman answered. Her name was Celeste. And she looked at me and her eyes got big and wide. And I said, I know you haven't talked to me in a long time, and I'm sorry that I've been out of contact. I says, but I'm so tired. I want to sleep on a bed and take a shower. Is there any way that you'll let me in and take a shower and sleep on the bed tonight? And I promise I'll leave tomorrow. And she closed the door, and I hear her talking to her husband, Al. And she comes back open, and she opens the door, and she goes, we'll let you come in. She goes, I'll feed you dinner. She says, I'll let you take a shower and spend the night, but the first thing in the morning, you're gonna leave. And I'm like, okay. And then for the first time in my life, I had an inkling of hope. And I spent the night at their house. And in the morning, I had a cup of coffee and a cigarette, and I was getting ready to leave. And they said, hey, you know, we've been thinking about this. You know, why don't you go to one of those AA meetings and come back tonight and tell us what it was about, and I'll feed you dinner. But then you got to go. And I'm like, okay, you know. And I had been through treatment, and I relapsed the day I graduated from treatment, and I was aware of meetings, and I used to sign my own court slips, and there was one meeting in particular called Drunks Only, which is now my home group, and it's been my home group for 21 years. I came crawling into the rooms of Drunks Only, and there's people in this room, there's a handful of people in this room who saw me that day crawl in sicker than a dog, dying of the disease of alcoholism, and I asked for help. And just like every good AA meeting, I had 40 people surrounding me afterwards, hugging me and loving me and telling me it's okay and you don't have to drink anymore. And we're here to help and, you know, come back tomorrow, you know. And for the first time in my life, I had hope. I felt a twinge of hope that maybe, just maybe, something's going to change. And I went back and I had dinner at that people's house, Helen's house, and I didn't realize it, but I had done the first step. I had admitted that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was becoming manageable. I took my first step, and I didn't even know it. And they fed me dinner, and they said, you know, we've been thinking about it. We're going to let you spend one more night. As long as you go to a meeting tomorrow and come back. And so you get my point. They did this one night after another night, and it turned into a week. And I had to stay sober, no matter how bad the compulsion was. But I went to Drunks Only every day, and I got the help that I needed. And I spent that first year of my sobriety sleeping in their spare bedroom in between a bunch of cardboard boxes on a mat and a pillow and a blanket, because that's all I owned. But I got involved. I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And about 3 months into my sobriety, I really found out what it was like to have an alcoholic mind. I was absolutely beside myself. I just thought my problem was I drank and used too much, but I didn't realize that it's a disease of the mind and that I was absolutely bonkers, crazy, out of my mind, running from people to people, going, I think I'm going to fucking drink. Please help me. You know, can I spend the night on your couch? I just didn't want to be alone. And I went to Old Town Speakers meeting that night, and there's a guy, I don't know, some people know him, his name's Cadillac Bill. And I ran up to him, and I grabbed him. I go, Bill, I think I'm going to fucking drink. And he goes, look, he looks at me. He goes, fine. He goes, I got a 45 out in my car. Why don't you just go out there, stick it in your mouth, and blow your fucking brains out? And everybody goes, Bill, he's a newcomer. And then he gently grabbed me and whispered me. He goes, or you can find God. And that's when I did my second step. I thought for the first time that maybe I can come to believe that power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I found a sponsor. He's here tonight. His name is Duffy. There is no play around with Duffy. It's straight from the book. It's what I needed. It's old-fashioned AA. We get busy, and we get busy right away. We do a step a week. And you don't miss an appointment, and you call me every day. And I said, every day? He goes, yeah. I go, why? He goes, because you need to practice developing new habits, and you're going to practice participating in your recovery on a daily basis. And I said, okay. And I did what he told me, and we got busy, and we worked on the steps. And then step three came around, and I was having a hard time with this, you know. And Duffy never pushed God on me, you know. I heard people talk about, got to find a God or you're going to die. Got to find a God or you're going to drink. I wasn't quite sure yet about a God. So what Duffy did was he got me busy. He got me busy getting out of myself. I loved what Michelle talked about. All I do is think about myself. I'm selfish and self-centered at the core. And Duffy got me super busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was picking up chairs and putting away chairs and taking on commitments and being all this stuff that I didn't want to be. And what that did for me was it cleared away a path of my self-centeredness that would open up an opportunity for me to develop a relationship with a power greater than myself that I'd never had before. And I didn't know it was a he. I didn't know it was a she. I definitely knew it wasn't a great white-bearded guy up in heaven or his son sitting on the cross. I just knew that it was a power greater than myself, and it didn't matter to me. I didn't care. I just needed something because I knew that I couldn't do this on my own. And so slowly over the course of time, and I learned this through the steps, is that you know, I built and I developed my own relationship with the power, a belief of a power greater than myself by working the steps. And so I had to clear the wreckage of the way of self-centeredness in order for me to develop that path. And then I got to the fourth step, and just like a typical newcomer, I did not want to do that fourth step. And, you know, and there was things about my childhood that I thought, fuck that shit, I'm never going to talk about that again. Never. Going to my grave, you know, because if I thought of, I felt those feelings, and I re-examined them and thought about them and felt them again, I was going to die. You know, and I dragged my feet, and Duffy kept going, you know, come on, dude, it's time. And like a good lying alcoholic, he says, are you done? I go, yeah. He goes, great, meet me Saturday at this park. And I'm like, super, we'll do our, he goes, we'll do our fist up. And I'm like, yay. But I wasn't done yet. I had lied. Once again, I'm still sober, and I'm lying. And I show up, and he looks at me, goes, are you done? And I go, he says, you have everything down there? And then I started stuttering. I'm like, well, I'm not quite done yet. And he's been my sponsor for 21 years. If you know this guy, he's 6'8", he's 240 pounds. He used to be an enforcer for the mafia and a bill collector for unbeknownst people. And so you don't want to piss this guy off. And it's the one time in 21 years I've ever seen my sponsor get angry with me. And he stood up. He walked away. He turned around and came barreling back at me and got this close to my face. And he goes, you know what? You think this is a fucking joke? He goes, you think this is something you can play with? He goes, if you don't do this, you're going to fucking drink and you're going to fucking dry. And I'm not going to be responsible for it. So fuck you. And he turned around, he walked away, and then turned around one more time and threw his big book at me. Got in his car, he burned rubber, he took off. I was pissed. First resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. Real resentment. So what do? I go to next week, I'm going around to people saying, trying to feel, don't you feel sorry for me? What an asshole he was, you know? Fuck him, I'm going to find another sponsor. And then I went to lunch with my friend Monty. And I was crying, and Monty's just being quiet. And he's doodling on a napkin, right? And he's going, yeah, And then, and when I'm done complaining about Duffy, he stands up and he walks up to me, sticks his napkin in my pocket, and he looks at me, he goes, call Duffy, he goes, finish your fourth step and do your fifth step. He goes, but read this napkin first. And so he left, and I waited till he was gone. I pulled out that napkin, and what he had drawn on the napkin was a headstone, and on the headstone was my name. And above my name, it said, rest in peace, R.I.P. And it says, rest in peace, Terry O'Regan, the man who thought he could think himself into right action instead of acting himself into right thinking. And I knew right then I had no more excuses. I had to do it. And I finished my fourth step. I met with Duffy, and we did my fifth step. And, man, what a relief. You know, they talk about that relief. It's the first time in my life where I exposed myself. I talked about the harms that I caused others, the resentments, the fears. And most importantly, I talked about my part in everything. And what I learned from the fifth step was that I learned how to expose myself to another human being and be completely and utterly honest for the very first time in my life. And it allowed me to become and learn how to become accountable and responsible as a sober man. And things changed for me. And I started getting busy, even more busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taking on more commitments, doing what I needed to do, listening to Duffy. You know, if I couldn't find something to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd go talk to some neighbor and walk their dog for them every day. You know, I would just do something to get out of myself. And then came the sixth and seventh steps. You know, and in the fifth step, I found out what my character defects were. You know, what were the most glaring things in me that were keeping me from being who God intended me to be? You know, and I wrote down some of them, you know, and some of my glaring character defects and shortcomings is that I'm a liar. I'm closed-minded. I'm full of pride, full of ego. I'm impatient, arrogant, prideful, unloving, and very selfish and unaccepting. So I had that down. I nailed it down. I figured out what it was, you know, where I was falling short. And then I came to the seventh step, but I had to humbly ask God to remove my shortcomings. And by that time, I was starting to develop a better relationship with God. So I sat down and I thought, you know, do I ask God to remove these shortcomings? You know, and I said, you know, I don't think that's going to do the trick. I think God doesn't want to help me remove these shortcomings. I think God wants to help me be the opposite of these shortcomings. And so today when I pray that God teaches me and helps me to learn to become more honest, open-minded, willing, patient, tolerant, loving, accepting, grateful, humble, responsible, and accountable. And I pray that every morning. I pray that every night. And for me, that works. I don't ask him to remove something. I ask him to teach me to become that person that he wants me to be. And through the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm becoming that man. And now in eight was a big one. You know, I had to go back to what I learned in the fifth step. I had to learn accountability and responsibility, and I had to take responsibility for my actions and my behavior when I was drinking. I had to make a list of all the people that I had hurt so deeply, friends and family. And, I got to it. You know, I learned very quickly after the fifth step, and you know, you never, once you have a sponsor throw a big book at you, you don't want to ever slow down. You want to keep going, you know what I mean? And God love you, Duffy. And I kept going. I made that list. I made it thorough list. You know, I got together and with Duffy, and we talked about it. And he helped me. He helped me rehearse what I was going to say to people. He helped me explain what it was and how important it was for me to stay sober in order to share this information with them and apologize and make amends and let them know that I would never act that way towards them again as long as I stay sober. And then I got busy doing the steps, doing the ninth step. And one of the hardest ones I ever did was when it came to my ex-wife, because I'd hurt her greatly. And I remember asking her to get together with me, and she was very familiar with AA, and by that time she was a full-on black belt Al-Anon. So when I came to pick up the kids at the door, she'd always have the chain on the door and look out through the door and say, "Oh, your dad's here." You know, but that changed over time, and so I went to make amends with her, and she said no. And so I went back to Duffy, and I said, "Why? You know, I don't get it. She's not doing it." He goes, "She's not ready yet." He goes, "Keep doing what you're doing." And I go, he goes, "Well," and then by that time, I'd learned how to become a responsible, accountable man in sobriety. And I was working, and I got the dream job, you know. And he goes, "It'll come with time. Just continue with your living amends." And so that's what I did. I kept asking that woman every 6 months for 11 years. And for every 6 months for 11 years, she said no. Then I gave up. I said, "I can't do anymore." And Duffy goes, "Just wait, it'll happen." And my daughter turned 18. She's graduating from high school. We have to meet together with the counselor at school. And I'm meeting with my wife, and meeting with my daughter and the counselor, and we get done. And my daughter by that time had her car, and she's ready to go hang out with her friends. And so I decided what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is to be a gentleman, even if it's with a woman that I had harmed and didn't really care for very much. And I walked her back to her car because it was getting dark. I opened the door for her, and she stopped, and she hesitated, and she looked at me, and she goes, "You know, I forgive you for everything that you ever did to me." And that's what it was. I finally got that amends. It took 11 years. It took 11 years of doing the right thing and never giving up. And I didn't even have to do it. She just did it for me. And it was a beautiful thing. It was gorgeous. It's one of the many things and miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I got done with the ninth step, that's when things changed for me. You know, people talk about that fifth step. For me, the ninth step was the magic. You know, it's when the promises started coming true to me. It's not, you know, the job or the money or the possessions. It was just that peace of mind and that serenity and that freedom. And I always joke with one of my friends, "Troy, how free do you want to be today, bro?" And he always says, "Free as a fucking bird." And I love that about him. And that's what happened for me. The magic happened. And so I went on to the 10th step. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. You know, this is a good one for me because, you know, in early sobriety, there was a part in the big book that it's called "There Is a Solution." And I thought, this is fucking great. There's a solution to my malady. And I do suffer from a spiritual malady. Let me tell you that first and foremost. I do suffer from a spiritual malady. The disease of alcoholism for me is a spiritual malady. And that spiritual malady is that I have no connection with myself when I'm drinking and my disease. No relationship with myself. I have no relationship with you. I have no relationship with society whatsoever when I'm in my disease. And I definitely don't have any relationship with God. And that's a spiritual malady that kept me drunk for a long time. So when I heard that there was a solution, I thought, God, this is awesome. What, you know, tell me what it is, you know. And you probably don't remember this, but you told me, he goes, the solution is, he told me this in early spread, he goes, the solution is, he goes, Terry, I want you to, when anything happens in life that you need to react to, he goes, I want you to think really hard and really long about what you're going to do. And then I want you to do the complete fucking opposite. That's your solution for now till we get done working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that worked for me. So many things worked for me, you know. I didn't do this alone. But in the 10th step, that's when I started to develop integrity. I started to be able to look myself in the eye in the mirror and realize the man that I was becoming. I had no more secrets. I had no more people to make amends to. I had nothing to fear. The law was gone. I was no longer on probation. I wasn't facing prison. I had fixed all my wrongs, and that's when the magic happened. You know, I woke up just free one day, you know. And then, of course, like a good alcoholic, I'm never cured. We're never cured from this disease. It's a ongoing process based on our spiritual condition. If I'm not spiritually fit, I'm going to step on other people's toes. And when I step on other people's toes, the longer it stays sober, the quicker I realize that I've stepped on people's toes. And I know I can hang in that resentment and then that shame and fear. And it's just going to drive me crazy, so it's much easier to go back and make amends quickly. And then when I go back and make amends quickly, I've cleaned up my side of the street, you know? And I don't have to think about it anymore. I don't have to worry about it anymore. I took care of it. I can let it go. So that was a very powerful step for me, step 10. And then step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to prove our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. You know, third step's amazing. I say it every morning, say it every night. And what I learned over sobriety, I learned this very early in sobriety, is that I don't want to pray for things that I want. I want to pray for things that other people need. So my prayers every morning, every night for the last 21 years, and they're the same fucking prayers, you know. It's the same prayers. I've been saying the same fucking prayers for 21 years. But they work. And what I pray for is I the first thing I do is I thank God for my sobriety, for a roof over my head, a place to sleep, job to go to, car to drive, money in the bank, food in my stomach, some peace of mind, dignity, and self-respect. And I ask him to continue to do for me, which I cannot do for myself, is that to relieve me of my alcoholism and keep me clean and sober. Then I ask him to teach me and help me to learn, become more honest, open-minded, willing, patient, tolerant, loving, accepting, grateful, humble, responsible, and accountable. And then I pray for the newcomers. I have a whole list of newcomers that I pray for, that I see at meetings, and I know they're struggling. And I pray for their well-being. I ask God to help them in their journey of sobriety. And then I pray for people that are suffering physically and spiritually. They're having difficult times. Their husband passed away. They're suffering with some kind of physical ailment or something. They're having a hard time with God. So I pray for those people as well. And I get to the finally, and then I do my third step prayer at the end. And that's where I surrender my will and my life over the care of God as I understand him. Because left on my own devices, I'll drink and I'll die. I'll die a very lonely death. And I don't want that because I love my life today, you know. So that's how I pray. I'm not so much on meditation, but I am really strong into prayer. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all of our affairs. This is where it all comes together. Remember, I told you it's a spiritual malady. I don't have a relationship with myself, but if you look at the steps, step one, I finally start developing a relationship with myself by admitting that I'm powerless. Step two, I start to form a relationship with God because I start to believe that there's a power greater than myself. Step three, I'm forming a relationship with myself and with God because I'm acknowledging that I can't do it without him. I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of him. See, I'm fixing that spiritual malady through the steps. That's why they're designed this way, in my opinion. Step four, made a search engine for endless moral inventory. I'm developing a relationship with myself, you know. I'm finding out who I am, what makes me tick, and what's wrong with me. I take responsibility and accountability for who I am. And step five, I form a relationship not only with myself, but with another human being, my sponsor, and I tell him all my dark, deep, darkest secrets. Step six and seven, I'm continuing to develop a relationship with God. I'm learning how to overcome my spiritual valley by turning my will and my life over to the care of God and asking him to fix me and help me. Step eight, again, I'm forming a relationship with myself because I'm taking responsibility and look at all the people I had harmed. See how this works? I'm fixing the spiritual malady through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Step nine, make direct amends to other people. That's when I get to form relationships with you and you and you and everybody that I've ever harmed in my life and tell them how much I love them, how much I care about them, how sorry that I am for doing what I did. Step 10, again, I'm going back, I'm taking personal inventory, I'm developing that relationship with myself again. I'm overcoming that spiritual malady. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to prove my conscious contact with him. Again, I'm praying for, I'm developing a relationship with me and then I'm developing my relationship with God. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, to carry the message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. You know, one thing that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, one thing that Duffy has really driven into me, is that this is a gift of grace. This is some people call us miracles, and I don't necessarily call myself a miracle. I call the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous the miracle. And I just get to live within that miracle. And that's a gift that I'll never be able to repay in any way. And so what Duffy taught me is that I have to give this away that's been so freely given to me. I remember finishing the steps with him, and he said, I go, that's it? He goes, no, that's not it. And I go, what's next? He goes, now you're going to stand up at every meeting you go to, and you're going to stand up and you're going to announce that you've successfully completed the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that you're willing to sponsor men. I said, fuck that. Because, you know, I was still in my first year. People know me in this room. They saw me that first 3 months that I was sober. I was so broken. I would sit in a chair with my knees tucked to my chest, and I would rock back and forth like a little kid, crying. And then they would call on me, and the minute they called me, they'd start passing the tissue box down. I fucking hated that. Remember that, Mel? I hated it. But afterwards, you know, the women would come up and say, oh, that was so beautiful. Keep doing that. You're going to get better. And I love that. Who doesn't love women coming up to you telling you that stuff and showing you attention? And the guys would come up and give me a hard time. You know, call me a crybaby. Laugh at me. But you know what? They were laughing because they wished they could do that. If you're a man in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you don't cry in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're doing yourself a disservice. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I cried because I was so broken. And today I cry because I'm so fucking grateful. I'm not crying yet, Mel. You haven't won yet. Close. So again, you know, the steps of 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are designed specifically for that spiritual malady. And I remember announcing myself at these meetings, and no one was going to come up to me and ask me to sponsor him. I was a mess. I was a crybaby. I was all these things, you know. And then I'm like, Duffy, this sucks. You know, this isn't working. He goes, just keep doing it. And then I got my first sponsee, and he's here in this room tonight. Where's Joe? Joe. And Joe came up to me, and he was such a mess, he starts crying. He goes, will you be my sponsor? Finally had somebody that wanted what I had. And he was my first sponsee, and we've been sponsee for 20 years now. With a short little break there, I had to fire him for about 9 months. But and it's the only guy I've ever fired, by the way. But God, I don't know what to say about Alcoholics Anonymous and Proud Recovery. It's the perfect solution. The steps are the perfect solution for our malady, our spiritual malady. You know, eventually, I stopped asking guys to sponsor guys, and they just started coming to me. And I tell you, I've sponsored a lot of guys over the last 21 years. And Duffy got me busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got involved so much in Alcoholics Anonymous and committees and GSRs and secretary positions and steering committee leaders and, you know, coffee maker, supply person. I mean, you name a commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've done it, you know. And it's because I need to. It's because I'm responsible, you know. I have to give back what's been so freely given to me. It's my duty. It's my honor to give back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I don't do this, then I'm not gonna stay free. You know. That's why I dedicate. And I tell the guys I sponsor, I say, you know, the first thing, the most important thing you need to learn and understand is that you need to build your life around your recovery. Period. End of story. This comes first. It comes before your wife, your family, your kids, your job, your money, everything. You have to build your life around your recovery. You cannot build your recovery around your life, because I've seen way too many people build their recovery around their lives and stop going to meetings and show up after 12 years, 13 years of sobriety drunk, newcomers again. You know, I don't know what happened. I know what happened. They stopped doing the deal, you know. So I go after this like I'm a dying man still 21 years later, you know. There's guys in this room that, how much time? 5 minutes. There's guys in this room that I sponsor that are like family to me. We have shared secrets and close things with each other that are very secret. And I take the position of sponsorship very seriously. And because not only am I helping another alcoholic, that's where it starts in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how we stay sober, one alcoholic talking to another. That's a meeting. You know, by sharing and taking the steps with another alcoholic, another man in Alcoholics Anonymous, I get to take them while they're taking them. So I'm always in the steps. So that's why you need to sponsor people, because you're always going to be in the steps you're sponsoring people, you know. And I used to talk to Duffy. I said, when are we going to work the steps again? He goes, you already are. Because there's no need for me to work the steps with you. You're working the steps with everybody else. But he was always there if I need to, if I want to. If I think I need to work steps, I'll do them with him, and we do. God, I don't know where I'd be. If you asked me 21 years ago what my life would be like 21 years later, I would never come up with this life that I have today. Never. In my wildest dreams, if you told me that I would have the life that I have now when I was nearly sober, I'd look at you like you're fucking crazy. There's absolutely no way that's ever going to happen. You know, I'm going to finish with this, is that, you know, my favorite passage, and this is something that Duffy, my sponsor, taught me and drilled into me, and it's out of the 12x12, and, you know, I love the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I love the 12x12. You know, I love it. And the most important part about the 12x12 that I love is the preface. If you look in the preface in the very beginning of the book, Duffy made me memorize this, and he made me say it to him every time before he worked a step. And in the preface, it says the following. It says that AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature. If practice is a way of life, will expel the obsession to drink and allow the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And to me, that's the message. That's my message. And for that, I'm eternally grateful for this opportunity to speak in front of you and for Alcoholics Anonymous. I love you guys. Thank you very much.